Well, if you have your Bibles, if you'll turn in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 15, we'll keep continuing on with our as Kern gets up off the floor, we'll continue on with our study in the book of Genesis tonight. We're going to be looking at Genesis chapter 15. We are in the process of studying the book here that is the book of beginnings. Genesis means the book of beginnings. And we've seen how all things were created by God and how God unfolded His plan to redeem mankind after the fall. And we've narrowed our focus of interest here, which we'll be focused on through the rest of this book, to the development of Israel. And we're looking at now the first patriarch of Israel, who is Abraham. Abram, as he is in the passages that we've been reading. He'll get a name change a little later on here. But last week in Genesis, as we were looking at Abram, Abram went on a rescue mission. If you remember, his nephew Lot got caught up in an international crisis. He got captured by all those kings that went to war. There was an account of these 9 different kings who were battling with each other, 5 against 4, and the 4 kings who were under the leadership of Chedorlaomer won the day, and they took all the spoils of Sodom and all the different kings. And remember, Lot had moved into Sodom, and so he was one of the ones who was taken captive by these kings and was taken away as a spoil of war. And when Abraham found out about it, he had a crack squad of Israeli commandos at his aid. And so they went in behind enemy lines and defeated these 4 kings who had just gotten finished defeating 5 other kings. He routed them, and he actually chased them all the way. It was a humiliating defeat. And if you remember the story, then he came back with all the spoils of war and everything and his nephew. And the king of Sodom said, "Listen, if you just give me back the people, you can have all the possessions, all the bounty from this." And Abraham said, "No, I'm not going to do that. I don't want anyone to ever say that Abraham got rich because of Sodom." He wanted to always point to the Lord as being a source. So we pick up our story there in chapter 15. Let's read verses 1 through 6 of Genesis 15. It says, "After this, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. 'Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your very great reward.' But Abram said, 'O sovereign Lord, what can you give me, since I remain childless, and the one who will inherit my estate is Eliezer of Damascus?' And Abraham said, 'You have given me no children, so a servant in my household will be my heir.' Then the word of the Lord came to him, 'This man will not be your heir, but a son coming from your own body will be your heir.' He took him outside and said, 'Look up at the heavens and count the stars, if indeed you can count them.' Then he said to him, 'So shall your offspring be.' Abram believed the Lord, and it was credited to him as righteousness." All right, this story opens up with the words "after this," which means "after this," meaning everything that's taken place in the preceding chapter. All of the events that took place there, this big, you know, roused about with Chedorlaomer and all those funny named kings. And it begins with, after those events, the word of the Lord comes to Abram, and it's a vision. We're told it's a vision here. So clearly he's seeing something that the natural eye couldn't see. And the words that come to him are words that are consistent throughout all of the Word of God. In fact, it would be an interesting study. I didn't take the time to do it, but it would be a good thing for somebody to do sometime, and that is to go through the Word and find out how many times God has to say that to human beings. Because it happens over and over and over again. God's got to always say, "Don't be afraid. Fear not. Don't be afraid." I mean, it happens on a regular basis. And there's a good reason why it happens, because we're fragile creatures in a very unkind world. And there's a lot of things to be afraid of. And so, It's incorrect for someone to say, "Oh yeah, you should never be afraid." Well, we shouldn't be afraid, but the fact is we do get afraid. And the fact is for some reason Abraham was afraid. Because the first thing that God's got to say to Abram is, "Don't be afraid, fear not." Isn't it interesting, after the events of the last chapter, what seems to be such a great triumph for Abram? I mean, things were going good. He's just beat up on a really, you know, nasty king. He's been able to rescue his nephew. He's on top of the world, got a ticker tape parade through Sodom, all this kind of stuff. Things were going right for him, and right on the heels of that, God's having to say to him, "Don't be afraid, Abram. Don't be afraid." I think that's curious. It's a curious thing to begin with. Why was he afraid? There are two things that God says to him in this that kind of give us a clue as to why he may have been afraid. First off, he says to him, "I am your shield. I am your shield." In other words, I'm your protection. It could very well be that Abram, after this great, you know, triumph that he's had, was laying in his tent late one night and thinking about the events of the past few weeks or however long it was after this, and thinking, what in the world have I gotten myself into? I just picked a fight with the biggest, baddest, meanest king in this whole region. He's not going to just say, wow, he beat me on that and go home and forget about it. He's obviously going to be thinking in terms of retaliation. It could very well be that Abram is sitting there thinking, I have completely gotten out of my league here. I've gone up against the big boys now, and I'm going to be in trouble for this. I'm going to get hammered on this whole situation. Which, you know, would make sense. You know, there are all these times in our lives where we win victories in the Lord. We'll stand against the forces of darkness. We'll stand against temptations that come our way. We'll take a stand and do battle spiritually against our enemy, the enemy of our soul. We'll fight on behalf of others, you know, a family member or someone else. We'll pray and go before the throne of God and fight for them. And we'll see victory in that. And you know, there are always those temptations to think, boy, we are up against a big and bad enemy. We are up against something who is a bigger creature than ourselves. And there's a temptation to be afraid in those kind of situations. What kind of retaliation would our enemy come back at us with? But God's word to Abram at this time was, I'm your shield. I'm the one who protects you. So that could be one thing that Abram was afraid of. The other thing that God says is, I'm your very great reward. And there's the other thing. We realize these are tied completely to the events that took place in the last chapter. Not only I'm your shield in that I'm going to protect you from any ensuing action that may come up from this, but I'm also your great reward. He's just snubbed the king of Sodom. Remember, the king of Sodom was wanting to give him all these gifts and presents and stuff. And it could be, again, that he's laying there in his tent out in the middle of the desert thinking, you know, what did I get for all of my efforts? I mean, I worked hard to get my nephew back and now I'm sitting out here and I'm all by myself. And what's the big deal? Well, he's not all by himself. But I mean, he's just thinking, what was my reward off of this whole deal? And so God is addressing that. You know, I'm sure he's probably thinking, did I do the right thing? Did I do the right thing by taking a stand for righteousness that way? Could I have actually benefited myself? Maybe it was God's will for me to actually get some riches off of this whole thing. We actually should feel good about this when we see this. We should feel good about the fact that Abram may have been going through these things and God has to tell him to calm down and don't be afraid, because it reminds us that Abram was just like us. There's nothing spectacular about Abram in the sense that he was just a man, just like a man, like we are men and women. I mean, it wasn't a matter of him being some great and powerful being who was able to connect with God in great and mysterious ways. He wondered, he questioned, he feared, and God had to deal with him and speak to him and care for him. Abraham was going through the same stuff that we go through. We begin sometimes rationalizing, have I done the right thing by taking a stand for righteousness? Have I done the right thing by going into battle against my enemy and moving towards a relationship with God? You know, what God deals with Abraham here touches to two basic needs that we have as humans. And those two basic needs are security and meaning or purpose. Security and meaning and purpose. He tells Abram he is his shield. In other words, he's saying to him, and he's saying to us in the process, that he is our protector. There's nothing that's going to touch us. And I realize physical things can touch us. Things can happen to us in this physical realm and in this world as we exist on this plane. They can touch us. But in terms of what really counts, in terms of who we really are, down in our heart of hearts, we are protected. There is nothing that the enemy can throw at us that can destroy us, because God is our shield. We know that the word describes our relationship with God like a suit of armor, the armor of righteousness. And Paul talks about putting on the whole armor of God. He talks about the shield of faith that quenches the fiery darts of the evil one, the things that the enemy tries to throw at us that we may be tempted to think will destroy us or undo us, can't harm us at all. I read a story about a guy who was visiting a zoo and saw the zookeeper go in, kind of like that. Did you hear about the thing that happened up there in that other zoo where the guy got mauled by a lion? Well, this guy was watching another guy do something like this. It was somewhere else in some other place. Went into where this big lion was and walked over with a broom and poked him in the side and made him move, and the thing was growling at him and stuff like that, but he did move and go over to the other side of the cage. And as the guy was standing there saying, you know, man, you guys must be awfully brave to go in there and do something like that. And the guy says, no, I'm not brave. And he goes, well, then that lion must be extremely tame for you to be able to do that. And he goes, oh, no, he's not tame in the least. And he goes, well, then what's the deal? And he goes, man, that lion is so old, he ain't got no teeth. And so the bottom line is the enemy, you know, we got to realize he may have a growl, he may be untamed, he may be mean looking, but he has no teeth with which he can hurt us. In any true or eternal sense, we are protected. God is our shield. And we have security in that. We have confidence in that. Nothing can harm us. We can go through the worst experiences here in this life and in this earth and still be in absolute security in the knowledge that God is in control and protecting us. And ultimately, we will stand with Him. He also says that He's our reward. Everything can be taken away from us. We can end up with nothing in our hand except the knowledge that we belong to Him and He belongs to us. But that in itself needs to be enough. It's kind of the stuff we were talking about last Sunday. This is what we're made for. We were designed to be in fellowship with God. We were designed, made for that specific purpose, to be in fellowship with Him, to be in community with Him. When God created all that He made here, He made it so that He could share His love with this created order. And of course, sin and the effects of sin have screwed that up. So now we're trying to find ourselves, find meaning for ourselves in other things except for God. But we were made to be in relationship with God. And that's the only satisfaction, the only real satisfaction we'll ever know. So that's why it's a marvelous promise. I'm your reward. These are magnificent things that God's saying to Abram here. But then, you know, Abraham goes on and he goes to even deeper issues. He gets down to the bottom level of what his fears are when he talks to God and he goes, you know, I don't have any kids. You know, you're making all these promises to me that I'm going to have, you know, all this land and it's going to go to my heirs and I don't have any kids. I don't know if you've noticed that yet. And he's getting to the deeper level of his fears in this. He's questioning not necessarily God, but he's questioning this whole thing. Have I misunderstood you, God? Have I misunderstood what your promise was here? Did you really mean that I was going to have kids, or was there something to this that I haven't quite gotten? Because with all of this stuff, there was still an ache in his heart. There was still a hope for something that he had not yet attained to. There was still a desire for something more, which is present in everyone who follows God. That's a continual thing. There is something that we're looking for. There is something more that we desire. And it comes to pass in our lives that we come to a point, just like Abram did, where we suddenly start asking, what else is there, God? What more is there? I need the tangibles of this. I need this closer sense of your presence. I need to know that your promises are true. And that's what he's getting across here. God, what is this all about? Is this really real, what you've been promising me here? And so God says to him, all right, go outside, Abraham. Head outside here and I want you to look up in the sky. And that must have been a magnificent view. I don't know if you've ever been out in the desert or anything like that and looked up at a night sky in the desert. There's nothing like it. When I was traveling out west once and we stopped in Arizona, and I got out and I remember just looking up at the stars, it was like nothing I'd ever seen in my life. And I can imagine Abram out there on that cool oriental evening sky looking up at all of those stars and hearing those words from God, that if you could number those stars, that's how many kids you're going to have. In other words, driving the point home, yes, Abram, my promise is exactly as it was stated. You are going to have an heir. And that heir is going to bring about, is going to be a part of the plan that I'm unfolding to undo all that's happened in the fall. And so He's saying this to him so that there's no mistaking what the promise is. Abram, go out here, look up, look at all those stars. That's what your descendants are going to be like. The first time that God spoke to Abram and told him that he was going to have descendants, he said, your descendants will be as numerable as the dust of the earth or as the sands that are here in the desert. It's an interesting point here. As numerable as the dust of the earth. But this time when he takes him out here in chapter 15, he has him look up to the sky and he says, your offspring will be as many as the stars in the heaven if you could count them. He goes from the dust of the earth to the stars in the sky. Some scholars say that there was significance to this. The first promise that he's speaking to him of is the literal Israel, the actual offspring that will come from him, from that genetic offspring of the Israelis, of the Jewish race. And that is what he was speaking of there, the dust of the earth. But when he was having him look up to the stars of the sky, he was revealing to him the other aspect of this that gets unfolded for us in the New Testament, that there is a spiritual offspring that comes from Abram. There's a spiritual heritage that he had. Those of us who believe by faith, who have come into this relationship with God through the Messiah, through Jesus Christ, who came through the lineage of Abraham, are now part of this spiritual inheritance. And that's why you could have as many as the dust of the sands and as many as the stars in the sky. There is a literal physical Israel that is the fulfillment of this promise to Abram, and there's also a spiritual offspring that is us as followers of God by faith in the footsteps of Abraham who believe on him, the spiritual offspring that he brought to him, which is including us in the church. It says that he believed God. Romans 4 dealt with this, and we dealt with this extensively when we taught this in Romans. But Romans 4 talks about how Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. And this is the first time we have the concept of imputed righteousness. Imputed righteousness means that Abram didn't have a righteousness that was his own. He wasn't righteous in himself, but God gave him a righteousness. God imputed to him a righteousness. It's like a banking term. You would say it was taken out of God's account and placed into Abram's account, this righteousness, this right standing with God. And Paul pointed to this in Romans 4, saying this has been God's plan from the very beginning. This wasn't something new that was imposed by New Testament thinkers on the world, but this was God's plan from the outset. Right here in the book of Genesis, we see that the relationship with God works by him imputing righteousness and by us believing. This was Abram's great work, is that he believed. He trusted in God. He looked up at those stars and he realized the pattern of relationship that he had with God was that he had to believe and trust in this one who made the promise. You know, we have to be careful about this, and we have to be careful when we understand Abram and we understand his faith, because sometimes we have a tendency to idealize the faith of these patriarchs, to idealize the faith of Abram and these guys. And we look at it and we say, yeah, those guys were mighty men of faith. They had great faith. And sometimes we can end up beating ourselves up because we say, you know, I just don't have faith like Abraham did. I struggle with my faith. I've got problems with my faith. And I wish I could be like those guys. They had great faith. And I think that's a misunderstanding of this. I think that we have to look at Abram's faith and see how the Bible declares his faith and realize that it's declared here and demonstrated to us with a lot of flaws and a lot of shortcomings. We've started this whole passage off with Abram questioning God, saying, you know, I don't understand this. I'm confused about this. I don't get what you're doing here. We have God having to reassure Abram, don't be afraid. You know, questions and fear, those are things that we always associate with the antithesis of faith. That's not faith normally is what we hear. But you see, it wasn't so much that Abram had a mighty faith. It wasn't so much that Abram was just so strong in this powerful force of faith that he had that he could make things happen or shake things up. It was that he had his focus correct. And that's the bottom line of what faith is all about. Having a correct focus. Having a correct understanding of things as they really are. In other words, Abram was able to hear this promise from God saying, you are going to have so many kids, you're going to be the most famous dad in all the world, and your kids are going to be more than the stars of the sky. And Abram, out on that cloudless night, somewhere in the desert over in Palestine, was able to look up at all those stars and realize in his own heart, the God who made all of those stars, the God who made all of that and put it into place, is well able to do what he promised to do for me. His focus is on God and God's ability, not on his own faith or his own ability to believe, but his focus was right. His focus was on God and his great ability. His focus wasn't on the problem. His focus wasn't on the circumstances. His focus was on the ability, the great ability of the one who made the great promise. And so that's really what the believing that we're talking about here in the Bible is all about. That's the faith of the Bible. There are faith teachers, so-called faith teachers, who teach a faith that is really no faith at all. And I got to be honest with you, it's not faith in a biblical sense. What they'll say is, hey, you need to claim your promise. You need to dictate to God exactly how this is going to come out. You determine what you want. You dictate how this is going to happen. You dictate what the result will be. And you claim it and you demand it and you tell angels to go get it or whatever kind of nonsense they come up with. That's not the faith of the Bible. The faith of the Bible stands out there on the precipice of absolutely no knowledge of anything in the future. And absolute confusion even about what is really happening here. And if this promise is interpreted right in his own heart. But when he's given the word from the Lord that this is it, then against all rational justification, he says, okay, I believe it. I don't know how this is going to work out. I'm not telling anybody how it's going to work out. I am going to trust that the God who gave the promise is going to make this come to pass in his way, in his time, according to his timetable and plan. And that's the faith that's demonstrated in the Bible. And it comes down to even the same kind of faith we have to have when it comes to our salvation. That's why it's a faith that the same kind of faith that we use to believe God for our salvation. Who can sit here and explain exactly how salvation works? We can go through and look at theological principles, and we can you know, start to kind of go through a list of things that we know from a doctrinal position, how this kind of falls into place. But in terms of the actual mechanics of this, how are we saved, sinners? How are we saved and made right with a God that we can't see, that we can't touch or taste or smell? How is it we have security in this? There's a vast amount of things that are falling off of me here. There's a vast amount of things that we don't know, but we believe it anyway. We entrust our lives to a whisper on the wind, just like Abram did. And that's the kind of faith that God looks for from his people. Not a faith that walks around in arrogance dictating to him what they want, but a faith that sits in back and says, I trust the God who made these stars. That if he's able to make all these stars, he's going to provide the heir that he said he'd provide for me. I trust God who made this world and made me, that I have a meaning and a purpose here, and that my end result is a good end result, that he has a good ending to my story if I trust my life to him, if I believe him, if I trust him to fulfill his promises. Anyway, so that's what we see happening there. Can you fetch that for me, lad? I dropped my notes. We're going to read. We're going to keep reading here. Let's finish out the chapter here, verses 7 through 18. He also said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to take possession of it. But Abram said, O sovereign Lord, how can I know that I will gain possession of it? So the Lord said to him, bring me a heifer and a goat and a ram, 3 years old, along with a dove and a young pigeon. Abram brought all these to him, cut them in two, and arranged the halves opposite of each other. The birds, however, he did not cut in half. Then birds of prey came down on the carcasses, but Abram drove them away. As the sun was setting, Abram fell into a deep sleep, and a thick and dreadful darkness came over him. Then the Lord said to him, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated 400 years. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your fathers in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. When the sun had set, and darkness had fallen, a smoking fire pot with a blazing torch appeared and passed between the pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram and said, "To your descendants I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Raphaites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, the Jebusites, the Gophliakites." I'm sorry, the last part, never mind. So here we have something that is interesting, because it almost seems like Abram's kind of pushing his luck here. You know, he's questioned God, and God's told him, "Look, you know, as many as the stars," and he's answered him that way, "As many stars in the sky will be your descendants." Got it, you got it. And now all of a sudden Abram's saying, "Well, how am I going to know this is true?" Or whatever. We've got to understand exactly what he's saying here. This is not, I don't believe, a further questioning of God or a demonstration of a lack of faith at all, especially in light of the fact that the Bible just said that he was believing God. But I believe what this is Abram going before the Lord and in essence saying, "Lord, I believe, but help encourage me in my faith. Help my unbelief. I believe what you said. I believe what your promise is, but I need that help. I need that help from you to sustain me in this, to keep me on course, to keep me on track, to recognize this is for sure what you're planning on doing." This is a sense from him. "How will this be accomplished, Lord? I believe it. Don't get me wrong. I trust you in what you're saying. But how can I know this? How will I be able to know it? What will be the means by which I recognize what your plan is and how you're doing things?" I think this is pretty cool, and it's not so much a questioning of God, but an asking of God to help affirm him in his faith, just as the man did who had the son who was an epileptic and was going to be healed, and Jesus said, "Believe, and all things are possible." And he goes, "Lord, I believe, but help my unbelief. Help." Support me in this knowledge. There's a willingness to admit his own frailty in this. You got to remember, we can sit back and say, "Oh man, how could Abram question that? You know, how could he wonder about that? He's just been talked to by God and stuff." But, you know, Abram doesn't have the Bible like we've got it. Abram doesn't have anything but just visions and whispers on the wind. I mean, he doesn't have hardly anything to go by apart from these encounters that he's having. We've got the benefit of this word recorded for us. We can look at and hear from the Lord through this. It's a great advantage that we have. But Abram needed this at this point. And I think this is cool because God makes a covenant with him. And this is the first time we see this in this sense. God makes this initial personal covenant with Abram concerning what he's going to do. And in doing so, he actually shows him how he's going to fulfill all aspects of the plan that he has for the promise. Because we have to remember in this, as we look at this, that when Abram is talking to God and he's asking him, "How am I going to know this is really going to come to pass?" We have to remember that in light of Hebrews, what the book of Hebrews, Hebrews 11, tells us, that Abram was out there looking for a land, looking for a city whose builder and maker was God. This is not just about Abram wanting to know if he's really going to get this geographical piece of real estate here and if he's really going to get a kid and a grandson to bounce on his knee or anything like that. It's not just that. It's not limited to that. This is talking about God's plan to undo what happened in the fall. Remember, this is the book of beginnings. We started in Genesis where everything was perfect. And this is about God's plan to restore what was stolen from him when the enemy snuck into the garden and deceived the man and the woman. The result was the sin that came into the world due to the fall. And the result of that was God's plan going into action to rescue what was stolen from him, to take back what belonged to himself. And that's what this is all about. When Abram's looking for this and God is demonstrating it to him, Abram may not fully comprehend what he's looking for, but from God's perspective, this is all about how he is going to fulfill what his plan has been from the time Adam and Eve fell. When he stood there in the garden and he said to the serpent, "You will bruise his heel, but he will crush your head," speaking of the Messiah that was going to come. When he was telling him the plan, right then and there, and he was putting into place, putting into action what he was going to do. That's what this is about. When Abram is wanting to know, "How am I going to know for sure this is happening?" God says, "I'm going to make a covenant with you." What we see in this covenant is a microcosm of the story of how it's going to be fulfilled. Because we see the very first thing that he has to come to grips with is that this covenant is going to be at the cost of another's life. Now, in the Middle Eastern cultures, there were a lot of different ways in which people would have covenants with each other. They would exchange belts, they would exchange robes, they would exchange names. And this was one aspect of the way people would have a covenant. They would oftentimes, and it was usually just one animal, they would take an animal, usually a cow or a bull, and they would split it in two. They'd cut it from the stomach open like that, and then they'd butterfly it like that, and then they'd cut it down the back, and they would pull it apart like that with all the blood and all the guts over all the ground in between. And those who are going to have a covenant with each other would walk into the middle of all that goo, and they'd walk around each other in a figure eight pattern, and they'd come out on the other side. And that was symbolic of their determination. And Jeremiah kind of even references this. You negated the covenant where you walked between the pieces. And the idea was, I will cut you in two because of what you did there. And that was the idea behind the covenant. This is so binding that it would tear us asunder if we were to break this covenant that we have with each other. And people would make covenants for all kinds of reasons. It would always be, you know, usually people of equal power coming together to form alliances for war, or to form alliances for protection or peace, or to form alliances for economic gain, you know, maybe for property or lands, things like that. And they would create this alliance with each other, and this was one of the ways they would symbolically show this covenant had come to pass. And so this is what God's going to do with Abram here. He's going to bring it down to an earthly level, in a level that Abram can understand. He says, we're going to have a covenant together, so go get me some animals here and lay them open and let's walk through the goo. And so Abram does this. And it's interesting, all the animals that he tells him to get, because they're very significant. He tells him to get a heifer, he tells him to get a goat, and he tells him to get a ram, and then he specifies two types of birds. The heifer, of course, is symbolic here of the strength and the patience of God. And heifers are always used in that kind of meaning. If we're to look at the symbolic meaning of something, the heifer is always symbolic of God's power and his strength more than anything, the ability to bear a load or a burden. And the goat is representative of the nourishment that can come from the presence of God. And of course the ram is representative of power in war, the warrior power that's available in God. The Lord is a warrior. A warrior is his name. And then the two birds were symbolic of grace and of peace. And all of these things, it's interesting that he specified to him that he wanted them 3 years old, the length of time Jesus was ministering. All of these things were symbolic of the work of Christ and what he provides in the life of a believer. God's showing Abram right off the bat that a covenant with me and a restored relationship with me is going to come at the cost of another's life. And all of these animals that are laid out here are representative of the kind of sacrifice that's going to be necessary in order to bring you home. And what it's going to provide for you is a strength that you never knew you had. It's going to provide for you a nourishment that will satisfy your souls. It's going to provide for you a power to overcome in warfare against your very real enemy. It's going to be grace and it's going to be peace to you. And those two weren't cut asunder but left in whole pieces, intact and complete in us. And all of this is representative of Christ through that blood sacrifice. And so Abram does this. He gets these animals all laid out. You know, he's out there in the middle of nowhere and he's cutting animals to pieces and he's laying them all out there, and it's just him standing out there in the desert and nothing happens. All that happens is he's standing out in the middle of the desert and he's got a bunch of dead animals laying out in front of him, and he's waiting and he's waiting. And clearly some time is passing here, because it says the vultures basically are coming in to try to get at the meat. They're thinking, wow, a buffet right here for us. And so Abram has to try to beat the animals back, you know, beat the vultures back and keep them from getting in on the stuff that he's laid out there. And it's interesting, because so often that's what happens in our lives. You know, we determine to grow in a deeper relationship with Jesus. We make sacrifices. We determine what sacrifices we're going to make as we live sacrificially. And things maybe don't happen automatically. Maybe, you know, we have a moment there with him where it seemed just really, you know, really powerful. We just feel so close to Him. We feel like things are moving along. And then all of a sudden we come back to the mundane monotony of life, and it feels a little farther away when we were feeling close to Him. And we're not so sure about these sacrifices that we were supposed to make. And all of a sudden the vultures are coming in. The enemy tries to come in with all of these things that would tempt us to try to steal away our determination, to take away that determination we have that we want to serve and to follow Him. And it was cool of Abram that he was diligent enough to stand there and beat that stuff back. This is just like what we were talking about Sunday. We have to fight for our hearts. That's the battle that we're called to. We have to fight to protect our hearts from what the enemy would try to do, to try to steal away those levels of relationship that we can move into with God. When we make a determination to sacrifice some element of our life, to lay down our own will and surrender to His, when we do that and all of a sudden nothing seems to happen and we feel like we're still going through the same frustrations, and the enemy tries to come in to steal that away, we have to battle with him. We have to steal our resolve to follow through with what the Lord has prescribed for us. So he's waiting around here, and the sun begins to set, and he's getting sleepy. You know, he's waited the whole day through and nothing seems to have happened. And just as he's getting ready, just as the sun's getting ready to go down, he goes into this trance. Darkness and terror comes upon him. It shows the weight of God's presence as he does show up. You know, this wasn't just some flippant little, you know, how do you do? Hi, I'm God. How's it going? I just was here to do a covenant with you. There was a horror involved in this. When he was suddenly, it's like what Brian talked about when he preached not too long ago. There was a fear and a trembling associated with coming into contact with this one who's benevolent and loving towards him, and yet quite powerful. And so God tells him what's going to be happening, and he forecasts for him what's going to happen when Israel goes into captivity into Egypt. And Egypt isn't mentioned here specifically, which is very interesting, because if this was just Moses trying to cook something up as a vendetta against Egypt, you would think that he would mention Egypt by name to make sure everybody hates Egypt from here on in. But he doesn't mention it here. As he's writing this, the revelation clearly had been passed down through generations. And Abram had been told simply that they'd go into captivity to another nation, to another land. And they did for 400 years. And he says that they'd be there until the time of the fullness of the sin of the Amorites had come to its fullness, which is an interesting thing. You know, you realize here again, this is the sovereignty of God moving through all of these things. You know, Abram realized that his descendants were going to be going into captivity. Israel went into captivity and suffered for 400 years in that captivity, but there was a purpose behind it. For one thing, God was going to reveal himself in a mighty way when he brought them out, but also he was establishing the absolute moral wickedness of the Amorites, so that when the Israelites came to dispossess them of that land, that judgment on them was just and righteous. God moving through the nations of the earth to bring about judgments. Here he was going to be judging the Amorites. So God sovereignly is working behind all of these things. And, you know, we know that's true for these end times. We know that time is getting short. The time when Jesus is going to return for his church is soon. But there's a time that this will take place. And he is waiting for the fullness of iniquity. And in that patience, in that waiting, it allows for opportunity for people to repent and to get right with the Lord. So there's his sovereignty, but also his great mercy. So then this smoking fire pot and flaming torch pass through the things there. You know, the word just simply means like an oven. So whatever, a easy bake oven burning all over the place, going through the pieces of meat there, and a flaming torch going back and forth. That's not British flashlight, but it's an actual on fire something, a pillar of fire. It prefigures, I believe, what Israel had accompanying them when they came out of Egypt. When Israel left Egypt, a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire went with them to shield them from the sun by day and protect them and to provide a light for them at night and a protection that way. And I think it was prefiguring that. And it also prefigures Christ. That's his protective hand. That is God's covering. He is a covering for us. He is a new life, a light of a new life for us that he provides. And so it showed Christ going through and fulfilling this covenant, walking through the pieces of the animals that were cut in two. And it's interesting, as we look at it, in Middle Eastern customs, both parties were supposed to walk through the middle of these things, forming a figure eight between them. But in this case, Abram is asleep, and God's the only one who walks through this covenant, which is indicative. Again, we see the pattern of how this works. God's covenants with man are unilateral. Unilateral means they go only one direction. God's covenant goes one direction. God's grace goes one direction. There was nothing Abram could bring to the table here. A covenant like this was supposed to be, by the way, incidentally, this is where we get the concept of cutting a covenant or cutting a deal. The idea is the animals that were used here. But when you had people cutting a covenant like that, it was of two equal parties who could bring to the table their bargaining chips, who could bring, you know, their side of the deal and show what they were going to provide in this whole thing. For Abram, there was nothing he could bring. There was nothing he could provide. In fact, God knocked him out to keep him out of the way. You stay over there and sleep for a little while because I'm going to go do this. Because God is the only one who can fulfill a covenant like this. This had to come from God's side only. There was nothing that Abraham was going to bring. What could he have brought? Oh, he had some goats and cows and servants and stuff. But what does God need with that? In the Psalms, remember, we've quoted that many times. God says, I own the cattle on a thousand hill. If I had a need, I wouldn't tell you. I got everything I need. I am God, after all. But the point is Abram couldn't bring anything to this covenant. This was God's grace demonstrated to mankind, and it sets the pattern from here on in. The folly that man falls into over and over again is to think that we have to somehow work to earn God's favor, that there's something that we need to bring to the table here to bargain with God. Well, God, if you will save me, if you will take care of me, then I'll do this for you and I'll do that for you. And that's foolishness. It has nothing to do with the revelation that's given to us concerning God out of this Bible. It's all from God's side. There's nothing we can bring to this. This is grace and grace alone that saves us. And our place in this is exactly the same as Abram's. We are called to believe the promise. Now, in Romans, we're dealing with the other aspect of that, that though we're called to believe and salvation is by faith and faith alone, the other aspect is how do we live in light of that revelation? How is our relationship with Christ expressed? Doesn't mean that we do good works to earn merit or salvation, but as Christians, we behave in a way that demonstrates our returned love for Him because of what He's done for us. But in terms of earning salvation, it cannot be done. Abram was kept asleep while God walked through the pieces of the sacrifice, because God alone was capable of pulling this off on His behalf and on our behalf. So this is a declaration right here of salvation by grace. Right from the very beginning, we see that God's pattern and His plan was to rescue us, not based on how well we could do, not based on how well we could perform, but based solely on the fact that He desires us, that He loves us, and it's His love for us that ultimately brings us home. And so that's what He does. He goes through this and promises him this land that He's going to give him, where all the ites are living. He's going to kick out the ites and let the Israelites go in, the otherites. So that's where we'll stop tonight. Next time we'll look at how Sarai tries to take matters into her own hands with disastrous results to this very day. Yeah, dun 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 dun. Stay tuned.